Before we get started, I want to remind you that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available. Go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page, and there you have it.
Commentary Trap. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host Frank Thompson, about whom it was once said, "The hand of God reaching down into the mire couldn't elevate me to the depths of degradation." I was a little stung by that, I have to say. The guest today is Craig Barron, who is a brilliant visual effects supervisor and matte artist and also a great film historian and a terrific guy. I've known Craig for about 10 years. We met on the set of The Alamo. And if you don't think that that would make me like somebody, well, you don't know me very well. Craig has worked on an astonishing number of great films and of popular films. Empire Strikes Back, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Poltergeist, Goonies, Labyrinth, Arachnophobia, Batman Returns, Casino, Titanic, Independence Day, The Truman Show, just goes on and on and on and on and on. But as gifted a visual effects supervisor as he is, he's also really well-versed in film history, and we heard Ben Burtt last time talk about the programs that he and Craig do for the Academy, in which they take a classic film like Gunga Din or King Kong or one of the Tarzan films, and they break it down, and Craig talks about the visual effects in the film, and Ben talks about the sound effects in the film, and they are always not only incredibly educational, but highly entertaining presentations. And if you ever get a chance to see them, give one, go to it, no matter what the film is, because it's going to be fascinating. So we talked a little bit with Ben last week about the programs that they do together, and so there's a little bit of overlap here, because I talked with Craig actually the day before I talked with Ben. The reason I switched them is that this one involved a little bit more editing, and that was because of Ben Burtt, who called a couple of times during the interview and then who showed up in person because they're neighbors and good friends, and Ben wanted to come by and say hello. So there are actually three or four points during the interview that I had to go in and do a little patching, whereas the one with Ben from last time was seamless as it was. So we just threw that one up first and did a little bit of work on the one that we're airing tonight. Do you even say airing? Do I talk about this too much? Do I mention this too often? It's not airing. It's not airing anywhere. It's not broadcasting anywhere. Ah, brave new world that has such people in it as me. Dumbbells. Anyway, I hope that you will enjoy this wonderful talk with the great Craig Barron, and we'll see you on the other side.
Like a lot of people that get their start in the film industry, a lot of it has to do with being in the right place at the right time. I had always been interested in visual effects, and when I grew up in the let's say the 70s, before Star Wars came out, there wasn't a lot of movies that were that interesting for teenagers. You know, for people interested in fantasy, science fiction, or adventure movies. You know, this was the time of The Godfather, or Last sure. Tango in Paris, or Dirty Harry. Well, I like Dirty Harry, but these were sort of, you know, the Vietnam War was going on, these were violent times, and the sort of the fun aspect of going to the movies, you know, the ability to participate in an adventure resided with classic movies. Films like Gunga Din at RKO, or big visual effects pictures, which might be, say, biblical epics like The Ten Commandments or Ben-Hur, or something like that. Something with spectacle and production value was not really being made at the time. And that, of course, would come back later. But so my generation was sort of looking back a little bit. We were looking to the history of film to be inspired. And then eventually, you know, people like Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, came onto the scene and started making films like Star Wars and Close Encounters, and then brought that whole genre back. You know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, of course, is a perfect example.
Sure.
It became, you know, fun to go back to the movies again.
Yeah, those guys were really steeped in an earlier era of movies. I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark is very definitely based on the serials of the 30s, although does it in a way that those serials never could have imagined.
Yeah, I don't know aspiring if you, to. You notice in my room there's a poster sure. of Perils of Nyoka, which is sort of a very loose template for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And interestingly, in the serial, the Indiana Jones character is played by a woman, which was
yes.
even more adventurous for the time. But yeah, I think we were, you know, we were needing to get back to the movies and have fun again. You know, I mean, there was obviously, you know, coming out of the 60s, there was a lot of rebellion, sort of the social mores and taboos were sort of being removed, and the codes were being abandoned, and movies like The Wild Bunch, which, you know, are fantastic, but there's an orgy of violence that if you weren't used to, that was quite an impact. You don't get that today. We're also desensitized to this stuff, but this was sort of, you know, happening for the first time. And those are all great movies. I don't want to say that these aren't important movies for the history of film. But for a teenage boy, what I wanted to see was something different. You know, the films of, say, Ray Harryhausen. But he only made a film every couple years.
Sure.
So you had a long time to wait. And now, of course, you know, with the summer tentpole extravaganza, there seemingly are too many of these types of films being released every year. So it really has, you know, I've seen the arc of it, you know, from the very beginning to today, which now the summer tentpole movies are extremely important to keep the studio solvent, and they have to be extremely successful in order to keep Hollywood going. So it's been an interesting journey.
What I'm finding about the tentpole pictures now is that there seems to be a certain sameness and structure to them. There's some that I like, some that I don't care for, but they all seem to have the same structure of how they begin, what the exposition in the middle is, and then the big blow up at the end. And
yes.
I'm waiting for somebody to really come along and rethink.
I am too.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I think that you know, in the 70s and 80s, you had maverick filmmakers. And then since the studio system, you know, had sort of fallen apart in the 60s, you know, a lot of the studios were closing and, you know, a whole new crop of directors were coming up, like Marty Scorsese and people like that. Hollywood didn't understand, you know, how to make that transition back then. So there was a lot of opportunity and a lot of experimentation. And a lot to rebel against. And now everything is much more of an institutionalized business. And you're absolutely right. I make the same comment myself, and just in a slightly different way. My observation is a certain vocabulary that we see in movies now, summer tentpole movies, which, you know, always is very similar. And although they are still extremely profitable, there is a template aspect to it, which starts to get a little stagnant. And I'm concerned that there needs to be enough innovation in the system to break that mold every once in a while. Or the same thing happens where a certain kind of picture ends up being unpopular until the industry is able to reinvent itself.
But it's always been that way throughout the history of movies, in a way, because you can look at, say, musical comedies of the 40s, mm-hmm. and there is a certain structure that most of them adhered to. They differed only by the ultimate creativity of the people putting it together.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But there's a certain sameness in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always a tendency. And then somebody will come along and break the mold and say, enough of this. I mean, that's the French New Wave was all about getting to the end of the 50s or the middle of the 50s and looking at French cinema and saying, all of these movies look alike. We need to do something that these movies aren't doing. And so the trouble with the tentpole pictures is that they're so incredibly expensive that it's hard for a maverick to come in and blow those things off kilter. You know, it's they're money first.
Right? Yeah, and I think we have to note the passing of George Lucas's studio, in so much as that he sold his properties to Disney. You know, George certainly was this huge maverick filmmaker who could make any film he wanted.
Sure.
And that's so rare right now. You know, people that are deciding what films are made are corporate decisions with marketing consideration, and you know, it's safer usually to sort of say, well, this film was successful. The reason why we want to have a franchise is because we know how many people saw the film before, so there's a good chance they're going to come and see the sequel. These are all the things to leverage your bet, so to speak, to try to get a handle on what it is to make movies and for them to be profitable. And I certainly understand the business side of it.
Well, sure.
Is necessary to survive. And the studios all went through boom and bust periods. I mean, it was very, you know, it was very dicey for many years as studios made that transition.
Yeah.
You know, when Fox was doing Cleopatra, the famous stories that, you know, that almost sunk the studio, one film.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until Star Wars came out that they even got their footing back, you know, that it was, they were out of the hole. So it's extremely difficult business, an entertainment business, where the recipe is illusionary. You know, it's ephemeral. You can't quite get your hand on it. If everybody knew what would make a great, successful film, we would do it every time.
Sure.
And everyone sets out to make a successful film every time. But it's not. There's something that happens that's a quality where the film comes together and it becomes magical, or it doesn't gel and it doesn't. And nobody can really 100% guarantee that formula, no matter what. And that's actually why it's attractive.
Sure.
Because there's something at stake and something at risk. But obviously, now that the studios are more, you know, multinational and they have ancillary ways, you know, it's not just film production, it's, you know, toys or television or other media, theme parks. These are the things that help offset the losses when they do have a failure to keep studios solvent.
Yeah, you never saw the Chinatown action figures, did you?
Well, that may be coming.
Yeah.
yes. And I love Chinatown, and there's still indie, there's what's called indie cred.
Sure.
And the thing about the technology of the digital age, which is a gift to filmmakers, that our generation now has that no one ever had before, is that you can reduce the cost of making film and you can get in there and participate and make a film. And that really is amazing, because obviously you look at an artist like Orson Welles, who made amazing films in the studio system like Citizen Kane, Magnificent Ambersons, and Touch of Evil. But clearly he couldn't afford to make movies. You know, he was too much of a risk.
Sure.
And Orson Welles today could get a digital camera and make a movie, you know. And if you are brilliant, if you have something to say that's engaging and compelling to an audience, you can be successful.
Yeah. You can actually get it to an audience without the studio ever knowing what happened. I mean, you can...
There's clearly other ways, other distribution models, which, of course, are concerning the studios.
Sure.
But, you know, the idea that, you know... Netflix, for example, is creating original programming that's downloadable directly. There will be obviously other instruments or other ways to be entertained. And I hope it doesn't adversely affect the film going experience, because I think that is an important experience to hang on to. I think people do like to go out to the movies. They like to go on dates. They like to have the excitement of being with an audience, seeing a picture, and that sort of collaborative feeling of excitement that's infectious. I think we like that as a society. We like to be as social creatures, and if we're too much stuck in our own man caves, you know, I think we get too isolated. So I hope that there is still the future for cinema. I think there will be, and it's important to keep in mind that as we make films, that we protect that mechanism of seeing movies.
I hope so, too. Unlike many of my peers, I don't object to all the various, you know, when people complain about people watching things on their iPhones. I don't mind. Whatever gets them into the movie is okay with me. But I hope that a certain proportion of them will come to realize how effective a big screen film with an audience is. Because to me, that's the real experience. And it's not only a big film. You know, everybody always talks about Lawrence of Arabia on your iPhone as being the ultimate insult. And, of course, it is. But it's not only big films. It's any film. You see, as you said, Gunga Din, but see it in a beautiful 35-millimeter print with an audience of hundreds of people, and it's a transformative experience. It's very different than watching it on TV by yourself in a well-lit living room, you know?
I think, and I have an example of that, is that my wife has two boys from a previous marriage, both teenagers. Well, actually, one has just started college now, and one's in high school. So teenager and teenager plus.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first met them, of course, I do love classic movies, and I always loved the storytelling aspect that you get from classic movies, because quite often they didn't have a lot in the visual, so they had to rely on character. And so that's why they're so compelling. Now, of course, we have maybe too much visual effects, and we don't rely on character, and so they're not, you know, they're not as engaging sometimes. But the I love Charlie Chaplin movies, and I've done some research on Chaplin, and I have done some seminars for the Academy Motion Picture Arts and Sciences about Chaplin. And so I said, well, let's see if Juliet's boys like Chaplin. They haven't seen a Chaplin movie. I mean, they kind of know who he is, but they haven't really seen a classic Chaplin movie. So I said, okay, let's start with The Circus. That's a short feature, and it's very funny. And so we got the DVD out and put it on TV, and they just could not get into it. You know, they were just too distracted. They didn't have the patience for it. And I was kind of just, you know, disappointed, but I kind of thought, well, okay, I guess that generation is just not engaged by Chaplin. I just sort of accepted it. You know, I said, okay, you know, I give it a try, but it's not going to connect for them. And so, you know, that was disappointing. And but, you know, I sort of, you know, we moved on and did other things. And then we just by chance in our local theater. We have a theater called the Raphael that shows classic movies from time to time. It's a beautifully restored theater. And they were showing City Lights. And I said, well, let's try again, because City Lights is such a great movie.
Sure.
And so I took the boys to City Lights, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And I realized that Chaplin understands the proscenium arch. He understands the frame and your relationship to the frame and your peripheral vision. He's totally using the medium, and it doesn't translate to TV. You have to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
And that experience was hugely effective for them. Now they love Chaplin films, and they will watch films on TV, but it doesn't translate very well. So us, you know, our generation, we saw these films in movie theaters. And then when we see them on DVD or on television, we're reminded of the experience of having seen them in the theater. If you hadn't had the theater-going experience in the first place, you may not be engaged.
Yeah.
So that's why it's vital for the next generation to be exposed to these kinds of experiences in the theater, for them to get on board and to really be able to appreciate the brilliance of the art form.
Just a couple of weeks ago, you know the L.A. series, The Last Remaining Seats, when they do the big
yes.
movie palaces and everything. Mm-hmm. We saw the 25 Ben-Hur
mm-hmm.
With a great organist, Clark Wilson, playing. And there's got to be 2,000 people in that audience.
Yeah.
And a beautiful 35-millimeter print, all 13 Technicolor sequences. And, you know, it was Kevin Brownlow and David Gill's restoration.
Yes.
And it's just electric. There's no substituting what that was like. And I've seen it on TV, and I think I have a DVD of it. And you can watch it, and you can enjoy it, but it's not like that. It's not, you know, when you're watching that sea battle, and those are not model ships, not like the 59 with,
yeah.
you know, which is all a special effects thing.
Sure.
These are real ships with real people and hundreds of them, and the chariot race is just astonishing mm-hmm. because it's all real. And
well, there's a little visual effects
well, sure,
in the
course.
Chariot sequence.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I have to point that out, being a visual effects practitioner. But I absolutely agree with you, and I know you're up here to enjoy the San Francisco Silent Film
yes.
Festival, which we are so privileged to have. And it's a wonderful opportunity to see silent films in a classic big theater. And last year, or maybe it was the year before, we saw Fairbanks in The Gaucho.
Yes.
Oh, my God. What a movie.
Yeah, it's great.
Unbelievable. There's nothing in these movies that isn't as engaging or compelling as any other form of,
sure.
of filmmaking. And just floors me. And I think the thing about it, too, from my standpoint, being a visual effects person, is I see things visually. And so silent films communicate ideas through images, which is my job. That's what I do. I also tell stories through images, by creating those images. So I'm very close to silent era and to the type of filmmaking like say Hitchcock, or you know, the type of filming that is trying to tell you a story through a visual medium, not so much reliance on dialogue. Because that's essentially, I'm not a writer, I'm a visual a person that tells stories through imagery.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing Safety Last this week,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen that film 50 times.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason I should be as looking forward to it as I am, but I'm looking forward to it because it's going to be with a big audience, and the Monte Alto Orchestra, who I really like, is going to be accompanying it. And so that's the way to see it. And you grab those moments when you can, because you don't get that many. And that's why we're so privileged. My wife would really love to leave Los Angeles, I think. But I'm not anxious to leave Los Angeles, because you can always see films there. It's always possible. Silent films and early talkies and 35-millimeter prints of all kinds, you know.
Well, quite often at the Academy, as we introduce a film, Randy Haberkamp is fond of saying what a privilege it is to be in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it's really true. In some cases, we'll get prints from the studios, which are archival, that they will only allow the Academy to see. On Safety Last, Criterion was involved in restoring a print, and apparently I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it with you in San Francisco. It's supposed to be absolutely beautiful. On the Blu-ray release that Criterion is doing on Safety Last, John Bangston and I did a little sequence for them, a little behind-the-scenes sequence, where John, of course, is the master of finding film locations.
He is.
And has written books about using his detective style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
He must be the best investigative lawyer of all time, because he seems to be able to find these obscure locations.
Oh, he's one of my personal heroes.
It's unbelievable, his tenacity to find new material. Anyway, John does a beautiful segment about the locations for Safety Last. And then I talk about how some of the special effects were created. Of course, the sort of classic illusion that Lloyd created of the everyman hanging from a clock, tormented by the experience of comedy and fear of heights at the same time. Juxtaposing those two ideas together for dramatic effect, he was a master of that. We talk about the technique he used, which, was a visual effect in so much that there were some safety offered in doing those hair-raising shots, although there was danger involved. It used a camera perspective technique and sleight of hand to create those illusions, which are still as effective today as they were when they first were presented on the screen.
It's one of those things, when you know how he did it, you don't feel cheated in having the illusion ruined, because it's so clever how he did it that it just makes you admire him even more, or how his crew set it up, because it really is an ingenious thing to do. And because it's all done in camera perspective and not rear screen or anything like that, there's nothing artificial about it. He's hanging from that clock and it looks exactly like he should look, you know?
Yes. It is interesting because, you know, when we give lectures quite often, Ben Burt and I will also give lectures for the Academy. We all sort of have to decide, should we do our lecture before the film or after? And it's an interesting argument, because if we're sort of revealing the creative process, or let's say how an illusion was made, do you want to reveal the illusion before the film, and does that ruin the experience for the audience? Or do you want to do it afterwards, and then they sort of missed it, and so they would have to remember what it was like in the film? And it turns out we tend to do our lectures now in front of the movie, because most audiences have seen these films before, and the people that come to them are coming from the standpoint of appreciation. And to reveal something about the creative process involved in making these films is sort of a new area, and an area that I like to explore. So, but it is a debatable thing sometimes.
It is.
You know? Rudy Belmer, a famous film historian.
Sure.
Rudy says, Rudy likes to come to the shows I do, and he says, Craig, you're going to have to let me come before the movie, because, you know, sometimes I can't sit through the whole movie anymore. And so another reason why we show our shows is so that Rudy can come.
That's a good reason.
Because, I always look out at Rudy as I'm doing something. And if he's like nodding yes, I know I'm okay. And if he's going no, then I have to check with him and see if I got my facts wrong. Because he knows everything about classic
films. Oh, he does. He's the master. I've been lucky enough to have him on this podcast twice, and I'm anchoring for a third time here. We're going to get him on again.
Let me tell you another little story.
Yeah.
So on Safety Last, I was sort of thinking, well, you know, of course at the time, Harold Lloyd was very secretive about the process that he used, his technique of illusion. And there weren't a lot of photographs that revealed the illusion. And so we created an animation that simulated what it was like to photograph him on the side of the building, using computer graphics to remodel the building and to have a camera and Lloyd. And we sort of take a scene from the movie, and then we expand it, and we create a virtual camera that's lined up with the camera that was actually photographing the scene. And we pull back as if you could pull back really there to show what the setup was.
Yeah.
And it's a great visual tool that isn't used a lot for sort of historical purposes like this, because obviously we use it in film visual effects. But I find it's a really powerful tool, because you can create the footage that you never could, that you never got. You know, as you're doing a documentary or writing a book, you need that perfect photo or you need that footage that would help you explain perfectly what you're trying to relate to an audience. And so we can actually simulate that now, and that's been a very powerful tool for engagement and discovery.
I wish I'd had you on my documentary.
Well, it's funny. So we made this animation, and I should just tell this story briefly. And I worked on some films with Marty Scorsese, and I know his editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, very well, who was married to Michael Powell, by the way. And I interviewed Michael Powell for my book on matte painting called The Invisible Art. So I got to know them. And I sent the animation to Thelma just for fun to show it to her. And she was like, I think you've gone too far, Craig. And, you know, and she said, well, Marty agrees with me. I think you went too far on this one. And I said, well, I don't want to disappoint you or Marty ever. That would be a disaster for me personally. But I said, you know, I got the idea for doing it by reading Kevin Brownlow's book. And Lloyd, in detail, explains exactly how he did the process.
Sure.
So I feel that since Lloyd revealed it publicly, what I was doing is only adding value to that by making a visual representation of what he was talking about.
Sure.
So I explained that, and that seemed to be okay. But it is something to be sensitive about, and that it is true, is that films are made to entertain and to tell stories, and technically you don't want the audience worried about the mechanics of it. You know, that's not the way to go. However, I think if we don't pay some tribute to their brilliance and discuss it and show help people understand really the creativity that went into making it, we'll lose it. Lose appreciation of it.
Yeah, I sometimes, well, not sometimes, often, talking to people who don't really know the silent era, and they speak of it as though it were a primitive time when people were just making simplistic films at the wrong speed. That seems to be what they always think the movies are. And I spend a lot of time explaining certain sequences like that, or from Wings, for instance, where the ingenuity of how they pulled all this stuff off is astonishing. And special effects come and go, and technology is always on the advance and all that, but imagination and creativity are always the important elements. That's why a 1902 Georges Méliès film is as charming and funny today as it ever was. Not that special effects aren't better now than he used, but that the imagination and the wit and everything else that he utilized in putting that together is still as valid as it ever was.
Yeah, I think it's that a lot of film history comes from a celebrity-driven appreciation. We know a lot about the movie stars and you know, their celebrity moments, and the culture celebrates the celebrity.
Yeah.
My take on it, of course, from somebody who's interested more in the guys that were in the trenches, were how did they create their illusions? What was a standard production model? How were films made? When you made Tarzan, why didn't you go to Africa? Why did you think you could make a movie about Tarzan in the jungle in Culver City? How could you do that?
Yeah.
What were the methods involved that allowed you to do that? And I think this is a whole interesting area of discovery, especially now since traditional visual effects and traditional filmmaking production from the studio system, we don't do films like that anymore. We don't make films like that. It's interesting to appreciate why they made those decisions, the creativity involved, and again, it's an alternate way to appreciate filmmaking from more of a technical angle, but also creative angle. And I think there's a whole area that hasn't really been visited. fully yet, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating when as I said, Ben Burt and I get together and we like to do these presentations for the Academy. It's a wonderful opportunity for us because we have the resources of the Academy to research and to study, and it just. We find things, you know, and sometimes we go, well, we'd really like to do something on Forbidden Planet, but, you know, the MGM version that, you know, has sort of was the first sort of important science fiction movie where it had a big budget being made at MGM. It wasn't particularly successful, unfortunately, on its release, and that kind of created B-sci-fi movies for years after. But it's a favorite of ours, and so we started to engage just in films that inspired us when we were younger. What are the films that we would like to visit, and that we appreciate? Almost like talking shop. You know, why is this good? Why was this, something to be appreciated? And by turning your attention to it and researching it, you can find brilliant creative decisions made by very talented people that were masters of their craft, and to honor them is an honor for us.
And sometimes, even when you look at the real early history of film, from I'm talking even pre-1910, the decisions they're making and the creative leaps that they're making are astonishing compared to what was built on later with so much more technology at hand. These people always had to use their wits and always had to use their imagination, and they really came up with some ingenious solutions to problems that they didn't have a lot of technology to help them get around. They had to build it themselves and jury-rig it themselves to get things to work.
Yes, that's true, although by the 20s, I think there was technology.
Oh, sure.
You know, and
oh, by that point, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure, yeah, Griffith and the very early, you know, the wooden cameras and by all means, there was a struggle. But very quickly, it came to a maturity, especially with the development of the Bell and Howell 2709 camera, which it's a Swiss watch. I mean, it's a precise instrument for capturing imagery, all metal camera. And in fact, it is such a good camera that we use them all the way up to the end of film. Bell and Howell 2709 was used often in visual effects work and worked on films like Star Wars or Close Encounters. Because of its precision and excellence, it was still a viable, highly sought-after device that was capable of the precise work needed in visual effects.
I want to back up a little bit before we move on and get your origin story, like Spider-Man, because you were so young when you got into the business. You were only 18 when you went to ILM, right?
Yes. At the time, I believe I was the youngest working member or employee of ILM.
So I got to figure out how you came to be that.
Well, okay, it's a story. I started my first year at University of California, Berkeley, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, except it was going to be in film. But since I grew up in the Bay Area, I figured I would do my undergraduate work here in Berkeley and then transfer to do graduate in the film program, because most film programs at USC or UCLA are graduate programs. So that was sort of my plan. And then George Lucas, after completing Star Wars, and that, of course, got everybody excited because it was sort of, you know, this was the film that we dreamed about.
Sure.
You know, from the standpoint of, as I had mentioned before, you know, of course, Kubrick had made 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was brilliant in a very different way. It was contemplative. about the origins of the universe, and that was fantastic.
But it's cerebral.
Yes, but Star Wars was, you know, an action-adventure Western, and hugely impactful for the culture and the audience. And since I was interested in special effects, and I had built stop-motion puppets with my friends and had done some composite shots, and that was, you know, that was fun. And I wanted to get involved in visual effects. And maybe I should also mention this, is that I had some relatives that lived in Los Angeles, so I spent some of the summers down in Los Angeles. And so I took the opportunity to make lists of all the people who would get screen credits on the visual effects pictures I liked. So I started writing down names, and you would see them over and over again, mm-hmm. because oftentimes department heads would be credited, you know, so I could start to see people like Clarence Slifer, who worked at Selznick, and others. And so I, when I was in Los Angeles, I would take the time to see if they were around, and I would call them up. A production designer, Walter Tyler, who worked on The Ten Commandments, for example. And quite often, you know, since the studio system closed their visual effects department and they were of an age to retire, they were still sort of in the Los Angeles area, but often very open to having me come visit them. And so I did. That was sort of a thing that I really enjoyed doing, because quite often, in the case of Clarence Slifer, who I became very good friends with, for example, he would have scrapbooks and things like that, and he would share his experiences with me. You know, so it's literally an individual who had given his career to an industry and had retired, but had the memories and stories of that he was willing to share with me, and I was excited to hear about. And ultimately, some of these led to interviews which found their way into my book. Eventually, I wrote a book in 2001 called The Invisible Art, Legends of Movie Matte Painting, and it's now out of print, unfortunately. But a lot of those stories found their way. In some cases, research I had done 30 years, 40 years before found its way into the book. And the exciting thing for me about that, it was an opportunity in many cases, the pioneers of visual effects to talk about their craft in a way that hadn't been discussed before professionally. You know, I mean, it was sort of an opportunity for people to talk about their aesthetics, their approach, their ideas, and in some cases they hadn't been asked before, because visual effects were sort of a secret thing.
Sure.
You know, everyone sort of had their way of working, and every studio was sort of, you know, cautious on how much information they were going to let out about how films were made. Because ultimately, like stunts, the studios didn't want you to know that stuntmen did stunts for the actors. They felt that would diminish your experience. You might say, we're not supposed to know that's Yakima Canutt, you know, doubling for Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind.
Sure.
Somehow that might detract from the picture.
Or Harvey Perry climbing up for Harold Lloyd.
For Harold Lloyd, absolutely. And so it was the same with visual effects. They didn't want you to know that everything just wasn't real, because maybe that would diminish your experience from watching the film. So these things were not discussed or talked about, and in some cases it was a real privilege to be able to find a way to have those discussions with people that were excited about their work and wanted to share their achievements. And so I was very pleased to do that. So I had that background of knowing a lot of the people who had worked in visual effects, including Linwood Dunn, for example. Linwood Dunn was a little more visible, because when he left RKO, he opened his own visual effects company called Film Effects of Hollywood. And in the 60s and 70s, I always say he was really the keeper of the flame of visual effects. He was almost the visual effects ambassador, because he would travel around the country, in some cases around the world, and give his lecture about how he created visual effects for It's a Mad, 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 Mad World or The Great Race. And at a time when there was no behind-the-scenes material available, it was such a revelation to sort of see him talk about it, and I became friends with him. I guess, again, when I was in Los Angeles, I would always go over to Film Effects of Hollywood, and they weren't really doing very much, you know, and he was trying to promote how useful a visual effects department can be to your production. He had to get the word out because people didn't understand that. And he was always great because I would call him up and I would say, "Hi, Dunn, it's, you know, Lynn and Lynn Dunn, it's Craig." And he would go, you know, "Oh, Craig, I'm really busy today. I really can't see you." And we talk a little while. "Okay, come over at 1 o'clock. It's going to just be a few minutes, you know." and of course I'd come over and I'd spend the whole day with him. And you know, he was great. And, he had this, office, and off to the side of the office, he had stacks and stacks of binders. Hundreds of binders, gray binders, and inside of them, what they were they were very meticulous technical data of every shot that was created at the RKO Visual Effects Department.
Wow.
So you would have a photograph of the live action before the visual effects was added, and then the result of the effect, and then all the camera technical data. And these were strewn all over the place, and stacked up, and I just went crazy looking through these things. And Lynn let me look through them, and I organized them, you know, for him a little bit. And it was a huge opportunity then to be able to sort of go through and just see this you know, a generation of people working on,
yeah,
on this imagery.
You know? Where's all this stuff now?
Well, the Academy has it. Lynn Dunn was very active with the Academy. Helped to be a part of the branch, you know, the branch when visual effects was identified as a separate branch of the Academy. He was instrumental on that, and later when I worked at ILM, I served with him on some committees, and you know, became friends with him, and he gave me a lot of material for my book. So there's some things that we were published that he gave me that, you know, was really, hadn't really been seen before. I was, Lynn would get a lot. Lynn was more visible than some of the other guys I had mentioned before. And he just wanted to make sure that you were going to do a good job, you know, because there were a lot of, you know, television stations that weren't that, you know, they were sort of, if something, he was involved with a lot of things that weren't done very well. So once he thought that you really knew, had a passion for it, he would be very supportive. And I'm very grateful for him for that. So, God, I don't know, I'm completely got off the track here. But so you had to have that backstory first. So I was completely into visual effects. I wanted to do visual effects. And I heard that George Lucas, after Star Wars, was moving his Industrial Light and Magic facility up to the Bay Area. And I thought, well, this is really exciting. I should see if I can get a job over at Industrial Light and Magic. And fortunately for me, I was so naive that I didn't know I couldn't do what I did. And that was, I didn't know where Industrial Light and Magic was. I knew he was moving up from Van Nuys to do the Empire Strikes Back here in the Bay Area. So I hung around Marin County because I knew George Lucas lived in Marin County. And after a while, you started to get the information of where he lived. And he lives in a very nice Victorian, big Victorian up on the hill. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to go up there and see if I can talk to him. Now, today, if you tried this...
That's a good plan, sure.
If you tried this today, you would be thrown in the back of a van and, you know, never to be seen again. But for me, fortunately, I didn't know I couldn't do it, so I did. And I walked up the hill with some of the puppets that I had sculpted or was involved with my friends, and some film that I shot compositing some visual effects work. And now, fortunately for me, George's house, the first floor at that time was also his business offices. So it wasn't insane that I was knocking on his door, because he did have secretaries there and he did have an office. And he lived upstairs at the time. Now it's just his house, but back then he had his offices on the first floor. And so I walked in and I met one of his assistants there, who I later would know as Patty Blau. And I showed her my stop motion dinosaurs, and I said, I had some film. I said, I'm very interested in special effects, and I heard that you're moving your facility from Van Nuys up to the Bay Area, and I would like to do anything, you know, that I might be able to help out at an entry position of some kind. Well, she took a liking to me, and while we were talking, George Lucas walked down the steps in the background. And Patty introduced me to George and said, George, this is Craig, and he's a stop-motion animator. He likes special effects. And, you know, I probably said hello, but it was probably more like some kind of horsey cough, you know, to meet George Lucas like that. I remember, I think I shook his hand, I remember I was completely flabbergasted. And George, of course, was busy, so he kind of said, oh, great, you know, hi, whatever, you know, hi, goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, thanks. You know, nice kid. Good to see you, kid, or whatever. You know, so it was a very quick encounter. It was very brief. But fortunately for me, Patty then called, Industrial Light Magic, which was in San Rafael, in the canal area, and said, George is sending somebody down for you to interview. So she basically got me my job by doing
wow.
that. Now, so what happens is I take a cab down to Industrial Light Magic, and because she said that George was sending me down, the top people of ILM's visual effects crew were there to meet me. Richard Edlin, Joe Johnston, Ralph McQuarrie, these were, you know, Jim Bloom, these were the top of the top people, and I'm, you know, I'm just an assistant stop motion kid, you know. And so, but they were all there because George sent me down. So they interviewed me, and then when they kind of got the, figured out what was going on, you know, a few people left, and Ralph McQuarrie and Richard Edlin sort of stayed. And Ralph was very nice. I really enjoyed meeting Ralph, and ended up sort of being his artist assistant in the map painting department. And Richard Edlin then showed me around ILM. And fortunately, I had this experience of interviewing all these practitioners of visual effects. So I knew a lot of the people that he knew. So I could sort of mention something. So he would sort of show me a VistaVision camera movement, and I could say, oh, well, this is, yes, VistaVision, and I would be able to talk about that. Or a CinemaScope lens, you know, it was first used on the Robe, and you know, I sort of had a lot of studies in technology that Richard could say, oh, well, this kid kind of knows what he's talking about. So that was very helpful for me. And then basically he just said, well, we have an opening in the map painting department. And I was really a stop motion animator, but I said, I'm interested. And so that's how I got into map painting. It was not actually my first choice, but it was sort of the available direction. And I wasn't going to say no to a job offer at that point.
Well, did you have any experience at all in painting?
Well, a little bit from painting puppets and doing little sketches, but I'm not really an artist so much as I'm a cameraman. I was interested in visual effects photography. And I love map paintings because, you know, I love creating illusions, environments. So I certainly knew it. I wasn't a map painter per se. And at that time, I was hired as an artist assistant, so I would help the map painters. You know, I would clean their brushes, and I would mix paint, and I would prepare canvases or It's a lot of times we paint on glass, so the glass would have to be prepared as well. And then I would do tests, photographic tests, to make sure that the painting is matching the live action. And so these tests, you know, you'd have to do hundreds of these tests because you're working on several shots at once. And eventually I did more of the camera work because they were just so amazing. You know, the artists were so amazing. They were so beyond me that I could help. But, you know, I have a few things I point at that I did. But the reality is that I excelled more in the idea of how to put shots together, what techniques were best to use, photographing the live action, and then combining that with the matte paintings, and then in some cases miniatures, and sort of then was on the path to become a visual effects supervisor, somebody that would run the crew be responsible for satisfying the director's vision of what the visual effects are supposed to do and how they help him or her tell the story of the film.
And what was the first film you started working on with him?
Well, the first film, I really started at the top. You know, I started on The Empire Strikes Back.
Ah.
And, again, ILM was just moving up from Van Nuys, and we were taking over sort of industrial buildings that had – they still had auto body shops in the same building we were working in. And, you know, we were always trying to buy, you know, people out of the bays so that we could take over and expand. And, in fact, the first year, the math department, literally just no room. We were upstairs. We were on the second floor, which is not a great place when you're trying to do precision work, photographing matte paintings. When people slammed the doors downstairs, it would actually bump the camera. You know, so this is the kind of thing you don't want to have happen during a matte shot. And so we used to have these flashing lights that we put in the hallway so that whenever we were doing a matte shot, everyone had to tiptoe downstairs. So it wasn't ideal for a while. But eventually we took over the entire building, and then the matte department went into the back of the building on concrete floors where everything was rock steady the way it should have been. But there was a lot of, you know, shooting from the hip and masking tape and long nights, you know, long hours to get that film done. And I hadn't worked on Star Wars, but it was actually a much more complicated film to do than Star Wars because so much of it was on planets. It wasn't all in outer space like Star Wars. There was big sequences on a snow planet or a jungle planet. And so these illusions were much more difficult to create. In space, it's really a spaceship in front of a star field. But in a jungle, you have to deal with making the jungle look real.
Sure.
And in the case of Hoth, the snow planet, snow is very susceptible to different colors, and all the color matching has to be perfect. And it was a picture that was infinitely more difficult than Star Wars. But then, you know, was really fun to be a part of because you were a part of something new that was just, you know, it was just coming up. It was just creating you were part of creating a whole new industry.
It seems to me that you were perfectly poised between the old way of doing it and the new way of doing it. That this is like where the turn happens because matte paintings goes back nearly to the beginning of the cinema, at least to the teens.
Yeah, actually, matte painting predates cinema. There's examples of it where still photographers used it.
Really?
Norman Don, who is credited with possibly creating the first matte paintings, it's hard to say for sure, but he has examples that he cites that he used it as a still photographer, like a photo retoucher. And so it predates. There's examples of it predating cinema. It's been around from still photography.
Wow.
So it probably is the oldest visual effect. And of course, Méliès is credited with coming across the idea of stopping and starting the camera, The story goes that his camera jammed while he was photographing one of the streetcars, and the car just seemed to disappear, and that became then the basis of his magic act, and the idea of being able to substitute objects or remove them through a serendipitous mistake is how a major portion of visual effects were born. But all those techniques, you know, the traditional map painting, widescreen, those were techniques that had been around for a long time. What we were doing at Lucasfilm at that time was readapting them and adding new technology to them. But they still existed as techniques that went back for almost 100 years. But we were putting new lenses on those Bell and Howell cameras, you know, new Nikon sharp lenses. There were new film stocks that could resolve more information. We were controlling the camera with a computer to make motion control so that you can fly by a spaceship model and have it glide by the camera in a very compelling way. We could add blur to things. Stop motion, by definition, was to pose a puppet, but Phil Tippett and Dennis Muren came up with ways of blurring the puppet so they would look like it was actually moving, as if the shutter was photographing the object while it was moving during the photography. So a lot of attention went into taking the existing techniques and then find ways to take them further. You know, blue screen had not been very successful in classic movies like Ben-Hur or The Ten Commandments. Richard Edlund wanted to solve that with optical printing. You know, how do we make blue screen composites look great? And so they had the money and the intention, since Star Wars was successful, to build this facility and to take whatever the state of the art was further with the latest technology of the day to make the effects much more viable and much more credible. And that would continue for many years until the emergence of digital technology, which would then surpass the traditional techniques.
Now, when did you decide to form your own company, or did you form Matt World yourself?
Yes. I had worked at ILM for, I think it was about 12 years, and I was very happy there, and we did a lot of great work, but I was starting to repeat myself, meaning, you know, by the time we were doing Raiders, you know, 3, we were doing the same shots over and over again, and there were a lot of shows that we wanted to work on in the map department that we couldn't work on that were smaller shows because ILM had to be fully staffed. So we tend to work on a certain kind of picture, whereas a lot of producers would like to work with us on a smaller picture, meaning that map painting didn't only have to be in big epic films and sci-fi movies. It could be in many different kinds of movies. And so we would have to turn down films, which were creatively very exciting, because ultimately it was ILM's job to keep all of ILM employed, not just one department. So we had to be a part of that team, and we did that very well for many years. But we could start to see that maybe it would be good to leave and form a smaller company that just specialized in matte painting. And my partner back then, Mike Pingrazio, and I did do that, and we formed Matte World. That was in business for 24 years.
Wow.
And so we closed that just last year. Now, Mike had moved on, and other people that helped me form the company as well. But we had a very good run. 24 years is a good run and a lot of great work to be proud of. But the industry today is going through some tough times. And we are, especially in California, it's very difficult to run a visual effects company right now because there is a lot of foreign competition. And a lot of foreign countries who want to stimulate growth in these areas are subsidizing the cost of creating the work in order to attract jobs. And that's very difficult to compete with. We don't have, in California, we don't have that help from the state or from the government. So it gets pretty difficult to, you know, to sort of convince a producer that they should hire you, but you're going to be 20% or 30% more. Am I always 20 or 30% better? Well, I like to think so, but it's not a business model right now which works. And so a lot of it is going overseas, and hopefully, you know, things will change, because I think certainly from the standpoint of CGI, we created that here in California with Jurassic Park. Phil Tippett and through his company, Tippett Studio, and also ILM, their proximity to Silicon Graphics, from Silicon, you know, which was a computer company. There's a synergy, sort of a technical synergy of creativity in spaces like this, which allow you to innovate and do new things. So, you need to encourage that. That Sure. requires an investment to hang on to. And the next generation of theater-going experience needs to come out of those technology art centers or places, and I'd like to see California hang on to that so that we're a part of that in the future. And right now, it's a bit tricky to see where the future will take us.
Yeah, it's ironic that California has not taken better care of what is arguably the most identifiable industry in California. I mean, it's the birth of show businesses is or the birth of the movies really lies in California more than any place. I mean, it started other places, but California is where it really came to its own. And more filmmakers seem to be leaving California because of terrible tax situations and no help from the government at all, where other states are giving a lot of assistance to people who come and film there.
Yeah, this is true. There's Louisiana, for example, Florida, and New York, all help to stimulate growth in the film industry, and that's why they are enjoying film production in those areas. It's a slippery slope, obviously. I think ideally I would rather not see any subsidies. I would just like to sort of see creative people have an opportunity to compete in a fair marketplace. Yeah. I think that is the best system that we have that ends up not working too well when it's manipulated. That being said, I completely understand that as a producer, films are so expensive to make today. And when a couple films, your studio's writing on a few of these films, that you have to take advantage of whatever you can to reduce the cost of making movies. And if Canada or Great Britain wants to, essentially, if those countries want to give you money to make your movie, to offset your exposure, how can you say no to that?
Sure.
You know, I completely understand. But you know, you will always need creative people with good ideas and who know how to solve problems and who want to create engaging moments for audiences. And so we may be doing less of it in California. We maybe, you know, now that filmmaking has become more of a global industry, I had mentioned earlier that I had a job interview with a company in China, and, you know, filmmaking is really worldwide now.
Sure.
And it's very different from, you know, just 10, 20 years ago. It's changing radically.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the thing is that there is so much hunger for visual stimulus in society. You know, we communicate a lot through visual images. And you can do that in filmmaking and in other media, but that is an important part of contemporary society. And there's a lot of opportunities to participate.
Yeah, we met 10 years ago now, it's horrible to think.
Mm-hmm.
On the Alamo.
Yes.
And that was, I wanted to ask you about that because that was an interesting situation because you weren't doing mats for that film. You were simply manipulating reality for that film, right?
Well, that's not, no, we had mats in Alamo, but The Alamo was a Disney film directed by John Lee Hancock, and that's, as you say, that's where we met. They built the Alamo as a set,
yeah,
which was hugely impressive. But we also then had to populate it with the Santa Ana's army attacking, and. We had many scenes, for example, at night with scouts, you know, and under moonlight, and so there were some matte paintings that were there to help you tell the story, but a lot of it, what I did, was help in filling out the battles. We had a lot of reenactors that helped to be the foundation that we multiplied and reused and extended. So that we could make the battle more historic and more accurate to the numbers that were really involved in the conflict. But I loved working on the Alamo, and I think it's disappointing that it never quite found its audience. But Billy Bob Thornton was wonderful in it.
Yep.
As Davy Crockett, And I had the opportunity actually to talk with him just last year. He was doing a film that he was presenting at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and I mentioned, you know, that I'd worked on the film, and he remembered me, and he really enjoyed the experience as well. So it's, you know, you never know what film is going to be a success or not. Yeah. We had mentioned that before. It was great fun to work on, and I'm very proud of the film. I think in time it may find its audience again.
I hope it does, because I think it's a terrific film, and like everybody, I wish that it would be released at the original version it should have been released at, because I think it was it was cut to its detriment. But
yeah, and I liked the John Wayne version, of course, and I like that form of epic filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, I always wanted to work on a Western, and I guess the Alamo was about as close as I'm going to get, because Westerns, well, maybe they'll come back, but the opportunity to work on in that genre is pretty limited these days. But I love the John Wayne film. Of course, he had many more resources and a much, much bigger cast. But even there, he had a visual effects shot,
sure.
You know, occasionally, so...
And he did basically what you did, because the day that I met you, or the day that we first encountered each other, I think, was when we were in the San Antonio part of the set, and it was just Santa Ana's army coming in and forming all along the street, and so it was just multiplying, moving people around, because there were only a finite number of Mexican soldiers, so that, as I recall... You would shoot them here and then shoot them here and then combine it.
Yes.
And Wayne does exactly that in the Alamo.
He does. And interestingly, I had met the visual effects guys that worked on the original Alamo. So it was fun to, you know, when I was a kid, so I was able to sort of pay tribute to them. And we did some things that were very similar, although we did add a little more complexity in that we were panning the camera with our shots. To keep it a little bit more flowing, because right now if you have a static shot, sometimes it betrays the feeling of the film, that it, because there's so much moving camera now that you know, it's not so much an assemblage of still shots. There's a lot of moving shots, so quite often a static shot will sort of betray itself as a visual effect shot, and so we were always trying to figure out ways to move the camera and to keep the energy of the film going. But but yes, very similar kind of work. And again, I think that the tact for that John Lee Hancock took, which was correct, was to move it away from the John Wayne film and to make it more personal. and more introspective, and
to take history seriously, I thought.
Yeah, I think you have to sort of step away from the dramatic effect of it. Although clearly there's a lot of drama involved.
I mean,
it's a stuff of legend. But it was very interesting to go to Texas and to see how much the Alamo is still part of the culture. You know, you go down Sam Houston Street, you know, I mean, it is, Texas is almost like its own little country, and sometimes maybe they think so, but, you know, it was the last to join the Union, you know, or certainly of that time, and they were fiercely independent people, and that quality remains in Texas.
Well, it's the only state that was its own republic for 10 years. So.
Right, right.
And you guys were responsible for really what I consider the most striking shot in that film, is that overhead shot of the fort being surrounded and attacked during the last battle. And that was the same thing, right? You just had to shoot people in various
positions. We had the army attack from every angle, and then we had cavalry. And then we also had elements of gunfire that we added in, so that we had, you know, from every angle we could put muzzle flashes. And then there were flares that we lit the buildings with, that were added as separate elements as well, so that you get a sense of cannonballs flying over that is funny. That was a shot I really wanted to do that was not planned, but John Lee seized on it and said, well, this is sort of this, you know, when you open a book about the Alamo, you often see the God's eye POV mm-hmm. of the attack. And it was sort of like, it might be nice to do that with a visual effects shot to really show the isolation of this one little group. Where the barricades are, how futile their, in some ways, their resistance would be to such an onslaught.
Yeah.
So even though it tended to be something you might see in a history book, and sometimes that can be dangerous, you know, like visual effects as roadmap.
Sure.
Sometimes is diminishing, but in this particular case, it was used really well, and it's a shot I'm very proud of, and all the work in the Alamo I'm quite proud of. I was the show's overall visual effects supervisor, so it was a great opportunity to decide how to create that imagery along with the director, and I think it turned out really well.
Did you do that overhead shot from a tower or just a long
we had a crane.
Incredibly long jib.
Yeah, we had a camera jib arm that could go up that high, and
it had to be up 100 feet or so. I mean,
in fact, the shot was planned from the computer. We built a computer model of what the Alamo looked like. And so we then said we know that the camera has to be exactly 100 feet tall, and the down 20 degrees down angle with this millimeter lens will give you this shot, and everything worked perfectly, and that's what happened. So so that the computer graphics is also great for helping you decide what shots you want to make for the picture and then plan for them, so that you could put the effort into making sure you got all the various elements that you needed to photograph correctly for their various uses.
Now, when I came to Matt World, when I was writing the making of book about the Alamo, and the first time I ever talked to you was during that trip when I came up to Oakland, I guess. Mm-hmm. One of the two big subjects in my life, besides, of course, the Foreign Legion, the Alamo and the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very impressed that you had done some work on Cameron's Titanic, but you only did a few isolated shots in that, or am I wrong?
No, that's correct. We were brought in to help just on a couple things, and ultimately only contributed a shot or two of the picture of the Carpathia, which is the rescue ship that comes in to save the Titanic. And what was interesting about that is that there was an artist on the Carpathia that actually painted scenes of the rescue. So we literally had an eyewitness account of what the shot should look like.
Wow.
And so it was then Jim, you know, Cameron was into the idea of making sure that it's as accurate and realistic as possible. So we were able to essentially recreate this painting. Of course, we had to then make it look like it was the inspiration for a shot that we were doing of the Carpathia coming to rescue the Titanic survivors.
I seem to recall that it took at least some of its inspiration from Ken Marshall's painting.
Well, Ken did also a whole series of paintings as well, and was a huge influence. And you know, Jim Cameron's right hand man.
Yeah. Well, he was the premier artist on the Titanic. That's for sure.
On that show. But the actual sketches that we copied and the journals were from an eyewitness account. Yeah. And that again, that's why the job is really so fascinating, because it's an opportunity to engage and learn as much as you can about an historic subject, whether it's the Alamo or the Titanic, or, you know, that's why I really love films about history, where we're trying to recreate something that existed, because it's this wonderful opportunity to delve into learning something that you might not have thought about or would have pursued unless it was an opportunity for you to create something artistically, and the marching orders are that it wants to be as realistic as it possibly could be.
Now, we do need to wrap up pretty soon, or else you'll faint from exhaustion. But I did want to ask a little bit about something we've talked about a little bit earlier, which is the presentations that you and Ben Burt do at the Academy. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask how those came about. And I guess you and Ben must go back all the way back to the earliest Lucas days, right?
Yes. Ben Burt and I actually met in gymnastics class, which we were both going to while we were working for Lucasfilm. And Ben was on the high bar, and he released, and he made this sound which sounded like R2-D2 flying, you know, through the air. And I said, that sounds like Star Wars, and then that's where we started to. We both worked for Lucasfilm at the time, and we're just cut of the same cloth. You know, some people just think the way you do; they have the same kind of interests. And Ben and I are that way. He's my closest friend. So when the opportunity for the Academy, I'm on the board of directors for the Academy. And I represent the visual effects branch. And so on the board, you're called a governor. It gives you access to the film library and the archive. And I'm also very active in the Academy Science and Technology Council. And part of the job of the Science and Technology Council as a part of the Academy is to find ways to share what the technologist does with the general public.
Yeah.
And so Ben and I were involved in creating some shows. Ben from the sound effects background and I from the visual effects background. It used to be that visual effects, the Oscar for visual effects also included the sound award. So sound and visual was the same award.
Wow.
And that sounds strange, but it's not, in some ways, if you think about it, because there's visual effects and audible effects. And so what Ben does is he creates sound effects. And that's an artistic form of expression. The sound of the lightsaber, the sound of the Enterprise flying by camera. These are all sounds that don't exist in nature, that they have to be created through a creative process. And then, of course, the imagery, because obviously these objects don't exist, have to be created. So quite often we'll do a retrospective piece on a film that inspired us or that we were influenced by, we will then sort of talk shop and contrast how things were done in the classic period and then how they're done today as a way to help audiences appreciate the classic aspects of film production and the contemporary ones.
Most recently, I saw the program you guys did with Jerry Lewis, and I thought that was terrific. I don't know how much of a nightmare it was to put together, but you really concentrated just on his work as a director and didn't really deal with him as a personality or a movie star or anything, but just as a filmmaker. And I think that even he liked that it was a different way of approaching a Q&A with him. Was that a difficult thing to mount?
No, it was great. And because Jerry Lewis was obviously a hugely popular entertainer who was given the privilege of making movies in an auteur way, in the same way that Orson Welles was, or George Lucas was. And he brought a lot of technical innovation, and this is where the Tech Council came in, is that he's credited with developing video playback systems so that he could be in the film and see his performance so that he would know that it was okay before moving on. And also he's was very involved in bringing the Nagra over to the United States at a time when the studio sound department was a truck.
Yeah.
You know, and so he could bring this small tape recorder that was of high enough quality that you could put it in it to record it what it recorded in a film. So it gave you this mobility. You could take this audio tape player and record the sound effects of a bank door slamming. And that could then be a comedic effect that he could use. So it was freeing for him. And so our lecture was about how he used technology as part of his creative process. And again, this is what I'm interested in, is finding a different way of appreciating the craft of filmmaking from a different angle, from not the obvious angle, but from a different way of appreciating what are some of the contributions that filmmakers and visual effects people or cameramen or the production model achieved that we don't really think about, but under examination, it's really an interesting journey to learn.
Now, you're working currently on one on World War I aviation films, right?
Well, yes. Our pet project, our dream project, is to do a presentation on aviation and cinema. Aviation and cinema were created about the same time, and there's some wonderful connections between the two that we'd like to explore. And that's our project for the future. And it's very vast. You know, we have to edit it severely to get it down. You know, it's funny. We would sort of say, well, what is it that we would like to do? And which is a great privilege to be able to,
sure,
to use the Academy resources to sort of say, well, wouldn't it be great to do something on Forbidden Planet or Gunga Din or, you know, The Prisoner of Zenda? You know, a lot of times things will sort of fall in our lap and then we'll be able to sort of research them and then we get excited about it. But quite often, though, how we decide a subject has a lot to do with whether we really would like to see the film again. You know, a lot of times it's just a great opportunity to see the film in the theater.
Sure.
You know, and that, I mean, in the most selfish way, it's just getting able to see, you know, Gunga Din in 35.
Yeah.
You know, which is pretty rare.
A good enough reason.
Our Tarzan series was very well received, and we redid it for Turner Classic Movies for their film festival, and again, it's just interesting to see how you would make a movie at that time and what were some of the technologies that were being developed and what was the innovation involved, and people like that. People like to see, they like to be insiders. They like to know how things are done or how they were done. Not everybody, but I think the people that really love films want to find new ways to appreciate them, and that this is a way to do that.
Yeah, I always enjoy those programs a whole lot, so keep them coming.
Sure, well, thank you. Keep coming, and we'll get to keep doing
it. Okay. That's a deal.
All right.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to do this. This has been great fun. I've looked forward to it for a long, long time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Thanks, Craig. I sure hope you enjoyed that conversation with Craig Barron. I sure did. Had a great time. Talked with him when I was up in the Bay Area a few weeks ago for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. Talked with a lot of good people that long weekend and had a great time and got more good stuff coming up in the weeks ahead. I want to remind you that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is now for sale. And I hope you'll buy it. The DVD has the documentary and the parody, which is what the documentary is about. They're both on one DVD. I hope that they're both highly enjoyable to you. I enjoy them, but then again, I would, wouldn't I? And I got some good, interesting news about the parody and Wade Miller's follow-up film, but I can't talk about it yet. But stay on the edge of your seats because it's coming up pretty soon. Also want to thank you for supporting the podcast, and here are some ways that you can continue to do so. To do it for free, here's how you do it. You just tell other people to listen, and as many people as you can get to listen, it'll be wonderful for me. Also, if you can go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating, so you can go there and do that, and that would be great. Word of mouth is great. If you want to drop a few shekels, and that would certainly help keep this thing going, you can go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com. There's a donate button that'll take you to PayPal, and you can give a donation. A wonderful person just did that a couple of weeks ago. And if it happened about once every day, then life would indeed be sweet. You could also buy books and videos. I have a page for each of my guests that will link you to Amazon to some of their books and DVDs and Blu-rays and so forth. And I have my own stuff on. You can look on the web, the commentarytrack.com site, and you'll see a page of my books and a page of my videos. And those are not only the Lost Remake, but other things that I've either produced or written or directed, or I'm just on as a talking head or a commentary track or something. And I supplied links to all of them, and I hope that you will avail yourself of those. So, as always, I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for doing a yeoman job as my announcer. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my beautiful theme music, and I want to thank James Hutchins for designing both of my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit both of them. Time is coming up pretty soon. You know that my Thompson holiday letter is going to be coming up in December, and that'll be on frankthompson.tv, and you won't want to miss that. Because if you love reading things that just leave you perplexed, this will be right up your alley. So, we have another great guest coming up next week. I hope you'll come back then. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.